Welcome to Influence, the Art and Science of Changing Minds by Steve Hughes. Do you ever wish you could just snap your fingers and others around you would instantly agree with you? This powerful program will teach you how to be more influential and persuasive in everyday situations, regardless of your position. Here's Steve Hughes.
Who here has ever received a notice in the mail requesting you to serve on jury duty? Anyone ever had that? Okay. All right. Question two. Who here, when they got that, hoped to high heaven that something would come and prevent it from actually happening? Okay. All right. Those of you who didn't raise your hand are good citizens. Good for you. But most of us are all into the jury system. It's cool. It's great. But it never comes at a good time, right? It's never at a good time for you. Well, recently, a good friend of mine down in Springfield got one such notice in the mail. She is a busy working mom, two kids at home, lots of stuff going on. And she thought, oh my gosh. And she'd already done a deferment like previously in the year, so she had to go. So she shows up at the courthouse Monday morning, 9 o'clock, with about 40 or 50 other people, walks in and was thinking the whole time, please, don't pick me, don't pick me, don't pick me. You know, she's thinking, what can I do to get out of this without getting arrested, right? And then within 30 to 40 seconds of the prosecutor, the person running the meeting and doing the selecting deal, with about 30 or 40 seconds, suddenly her entire world had changed just on what he had said. Basically, he got up there and he said this. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming this morning. Appreciate that. But I do want to tell you, I'm looking around the room here and I'm thinking most of you are probably not cut out to serve in this jury. Most of you probably don't have the wherewithal to make the weighty decision that you're going to have to make to decide what's going to happen in this case. I mean, I'm not asking you to pick a restaurant or choose a movie or even decide something as big as where your kids should go to college. We're deciding in this murder case whether this human being should live or die. And that's a big decision. And it requires a lot of thinking, a lot of focus, a lot of all the stuff that you may or may not have. In fact, to look around this room, we may have trouble even getting 12 people suitable enough to serve in this jury. But let's get into it, shall we? And she was amazed how in that short amount of time, she went from, please don't pick me, please don't pick me, to, I hope I have a shot. I hope they pick me. Now, what that prosecutor knew was, if he'd gone in there and been apologetic, and I know it's an inconvenience, and I'm so sorry, and it's a big bummer, and all that kind of stuff, and kind of apologized for it and said, please, please get into this, he would have had a hard time getting people wanting to get on. And he had to pick them anyway. But what he did understand, what we're going to talk about tonight, is this. If you understand how people make decisions, if you understand what things are important to them, and if you also then understand some of the psychological tools and buttons and tactics you can use to affect how they make that decision, you can be a much better influencer. Now, you notice the title of the program tonight, it says who? It's not the science of changing minds. It's the art and science. If it were that easy of just putting in these three inputs and then automatically, whoop, people change their mind, we'd do it all the time, right? I don't feel like going out tonight. Oh, yes, I do. You know, that guy, it's not that easy. However, I'm going to show you it may not be as hard as you think either. So if you'll join me for this ride together, we're going to look at essentially how can you, using just the tools you have, just what you bring to the table, and nothing else, how you can actually affect people and put yourself in a position for them to say yes or at least begin to agree with what you have to say, which I believe that is a pretty common thing, right? We face, as leaders in the information management world, there's a lot of challenges. You have to get groups of people and see, you know, CEOs and all sorts of folks to have to go one direction, and they want to go another direction, that sort of thing. So tonight, if you'll flip over the handout, for those of you who want to actually fill it out, at least you want to act like you're filling it out, that would be nice too. If you're doodling, I'll think you might be taking notes. We're going to use the numbers 5, 3, 5. 5, 3, 5. The first five are the five kinds of individual decision-making styles based on a huge longitudinal study done by some folks through Harvard, and it looks at how individuals make decisions. It's pretty fascinating stuff. The three stands for the three kinds of audiences that are out there, the three kind of audiences that you face. So the first one's individual, the second group there is group, and then the final five are the five P's of persuasion. You'll know I'm a big alliteration fella, so instead of just random words, they all start with P, but these are tools you can begin to use once you understand who you're dealing with and what's going on. Let's look into it. In fact, I think the best way for us to get started is let's talk about some stuff that everyone can agree upon, everyone can circle around and really find some agreement on. That's politics and religion. And He's like, again, he's not doing it right. Actually, I want to talk about an issue, and there are politics surrounding it, but let's talk about it just more from a communication and issue kind of standpoint, because I'm going to talk about both sides of it. And that is the idea of global warming, global climate change. Now, in general, there's two basic sides of the argument. Over here you have folks who believe that, you know what, look at all these facts, look, floor-to-ceiling facts, ocean temperatures rising, ozone layer this, all these kinds of things. That proves that it's humans' fault, we're at fault, and we need to do something about to change it, right? Very legitimate position. There's another group that has the exact same access to the same facts, ocean temperatures, ozone layer, all that kind of stuff, and yet they interpret it entirely differently. They say, well, that might be nice, but you know what? Long before human beings ever stepped foot on the planet, we know geologically that there were heating periods and ice ages and all that kind of stuff. It's not our fault, not our cause, not our fault. But now here's where I want to bring this up, because let's say each side is equally legitimate. In the middle, people just, I don't know, you know, come on, pick one. And so that's always, it makes me laugh on surveys. There's always the I don't know people, like, who are you? You shouldn't be able to drive. So at least not operate motor vehicles. So in public. So, but here's what the where we go wrong. Let's say you're over here and you do believe it is human beings. Thanks, Kristen, for laughing. And
I'm here for you.
Thank you. I brought my fan club just for fun. And let's say you're on this side and you believe that it's man's fault and it's our responsibility to change it and make some adjustments. What we'll typically do is we'll grab more and more and more facts, as many facts as we can, and then almost like beep, 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 you know, and just shove them down this person's throat. And all they'll do is to take those facts and say, thank you, appreciate the facts, love the data, but you know what, that just reinforces my position I already had. And same thing over here. If the folks who say, you know what, not human beings' fault, it's just the earth and heating and all that kind of stuff and sunspots, whatever, they do the same thing, beep, 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 throw the facts over here. Nobody's changing their mind. Because it's almost, if you think about it, facts and data are truly just neutral data points on their own. I mean, if I said it's 27%, 27% of what? Where? When? Why? Is that growing, increasing, decreasing? You know, how does that, where does that come from? And so it's the way these facts come in to individuals in which they process it, the neutral fact, and then have their worldview and how they see things reinforces what I think. And same thing over here. The same fact comes in, doot, 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 and they come over here. Almost like you ever seen those pachinko machines that have, you know, you spin the ball up in the air, and it's all these like hundreds and hundreds of nails, and the ball bounces around. It's almost based on where those nails are put that affects where the ball goes. And so what we need to do as mind changers, which is what we're all into. In fact, JFK once said, the only reason to ever stand up and give a speech is to change the world, right? Now, you may never be standing up and giving a speech per se, but when you get up to lead a meeting or to initiate a direction or whatever it might happen or some kind of important meeting going on, you are trying very much to change the world, not in a geopolitical sense, but you are trying to change the world in your sphere of influence. You're trying to say, we've been doing this, let's now do that. Or I want to remind you that this is why we're not going that way. Or here's why we need to make an immediate change because we're going to be in trouble, whatever it might be. But we're definitely all in the world changing business. We just do it on a smaller scale. So what I'm going to argue tonight is let's think about how we take those facts and how whatever side you're on, we're not going to spend the whole night on global climate change, don't worry, because it might get very heated. No intention. But anyway, I really didn't mean that. It just came out. So, but what I do want to say is how we can affect change by understanding how we can help people process those facts. In fact, Dr. Howard Gardner, a professor of cognition at Harvard, which, by the way, wouldn't be hard to meet him at a cocktail party. What do you do? Well, I'm an IT manager, and I'm very important. What do you do? Oh, I am a professor of cognition at Harvard. I'd be like, I'm going to get some more punch. What are you possibly going to tell that guy that he doesn't know, right? But he said something very fascinating in a book about changing minds. He said this. If I could give just one morsel of advice to mind changers, which is what we're all trying to do, if I give one morsel of advice to mind changers, that's this. Spend less time trying to convince others of your perspective, right? Just shoving it down. Here's why I'm right and why you're wrong. And spend more time trying to understand and thereby neutralize their resistances. In other words, spend less time trying to convince them why you're right and more time to understand and thereby neutralize the resistances that they have. Because until you deal with those resistances or whatever their foundation of their argument is, all the facts in the world will do nothing. It won't get you anywhere. So tonight we're going to talk about how can we understand where people are coming from neutralize those resistances, and then begin to have a more effective ability to change minds. Almost like, as a, you know, think about the prosecutor. He knew there was a lot of resistances going on, and he had done his research, he'd done enough of those things to know how to talk to people and get them to change their mind about serving on a jury. And he did it in about 35 to 40 seconds. All right, well, let's then jump in, and if you look at the top there of page 2, they're not numbered, but you can do the math on where 2 is. We talk about this. To persuade others, there really isn't a one-size-fits-all. And if anyone here has kids or no kids or has nieces or nephews, you know that you can't raise one the way you raise the other, right? That worked on your sister.
It's not working on me, Dad.
You know, that kind of thing. So you definitely have to modify and adjust and change your approach if you want to have the same kind of results. You can't get the same input with different people. And that's what Gardner would say, certainly. So you definitely have to change it based on project, based on person, based on situation. Each time you must make that adjustment appropriately. But you can't just jump in there. You have to do what step 2 says, is be very much like Socrates. And what did he say? You need to ask questions, you need to listen carefully, and observe intently. You got to ask a lot of questions. They'll tell you. In fact, a friend of mine does sales training. He said, the easiest thing about sales is people don't understand. If you ask enough questions of the right questions to your prospect, they will tell you what they want. They'll basically tell you the sale. You will hear the sale, and all you have to do is then deliver. I'm like, well, easier said than done, buddy. He said, try it. Ask a lot more questions, you know, basically shut your mouth and see what happens. It's pretty powerful. Which then leads me to, because we're just going to use this as a starting point here, influencing and how, if you want to be a more effective influencer, especially, we're going to talk about this on two levels. We're going to talk about people kind of at your level and below first. Then we're going to talk about people at your level or above, either in a client situation or someone who you report to, that sort of thing. So we're going to start here at your level or below first, and then looking up, all right? That makes sense. And if you want to be a more effective influencer, especially with people who you actually have power over and can tell them what to do, do that. Do it now. Make it happen. Yes, sir. You know, yes, ma'am. You can make it happen. However, if you're willing to be influenced by them in certain situations, your ability to influence them will go through the roof. Okay. In other words, the more open you are to being influenced by them, the more you'll have the ability to influence them when the time comes. All right. And I'll give you a couple examples here. In fact, here are the four R's of why that makes sense. The first R, if you're willing to listen to what the other person has to say, they can be an amazing resource of ideas. Right. Too often we think we got all the answers because we're in charge, we're leading the show, we got this kind of title. Well, it's amazing. There's some great sets of gray matter below you that can offer some good ideas. And too often we think we know it all, we've been there, and that what one little perspective can make a huge difference. They can be a huge resource. The second thing, if you're willing to listen to them, you have to do what they say all the time, obviously. They work for you, not the other way around. But if you're willing to be influenced by them, then you can have a better relationship. That's the second one. So they become a great resource for you in terms of information. You'll have a better relationship with them, which, let's be honest, when you have to ask them then to do something very difficult, a better relationship, call me crazy, usually works out in your favor in a more healthy operating environment. The next thing is, as you listen to what they have to say, you use them as a resource, you have a better relationship. The third R, they will have more respect for you, much more respect for you. The last thing is you'll get a better return on your time, your investment, and everything. In fact, people talk about ROI all the time, return on investment, that's great. I believe very much in ROI, return on ideas. What kind of return do you get on the ideas that you give out, that you suggest? And you have a much better return when you do these kinds of things and listen to what they have to say. Quick example. The last agency I worked at, we had an administrative assistant who was arguably, to me, one of the smartest people in the entire business, the entire group. She didn't want to happen to do the thing where you work 80-hour weeks and all that kind of stuff. She said, I'm happiest to be a secretary, do my thing, help people out, do the deal, and then go home and be with my family. She just didn't want all the headaches. But I found this. The men and women who worked with her, actually she worked under, those who had listened to her ideas on how to put a proposal together, how to structure it, how to modify a PowerPoint, how to serve something up here, the folks who listened to her ended up having better proposals, they had better PowerPoints, she had great ideas, but it took a little bit of humility on the people up here to say, who are you to tell me ideas? Just a human being with a brain? You know, call me crazy. And so those people had a better relationship, they had a better resource. They had more respect from her. And then, let's be honest, sometimes where five people come to her with something that they need done right away, who do you think she works on first? The people who treated her like a human being and listened to her and had that whole thing. So if you're willing to be influenced by people who work for you and under you, you don't have to do everything they say, obviously, but just be open to it. You'd be amazed how much you're able to then influence them. Same thing when the people who would listen to her had to turn around and say, no, here's what needs to happen, here's why. She'd say, okay, great, because you'd listen to me on this thing, I'll listen to you on that thing. And it's very powerful. All right, which now, another pop quiz here. This will not be on the final, don't worry. Let's say you have to drive someplace you've never been before, okay? The natural thing, I hope whoever that is okay, that let's say you've never been there before. Most of us will go to MapQuest, right? Or Google Maps or something like that. And the genius behind the MapQuest or the Google Maps is that they'll spit out the directions in two different ways, right? They'll spit it out. The first way is just the words. Go 17 miles on Highway 70, take exit 220, go 5 miles here, go to Strecker Road, and you're done. Great. The other way is it spits out the directions, and it's this very pretty map, right, with the purple highlight, and you can zoom in, zoom out, that sort of thing. So here's my question for you all. If you could have one or the other, but not both, okay, you could have either just the printed words of how to get there, or you'd have just the map itself. How many here, by show of hands, who would want just the map? Go ahead and raise them high. All right. Okay, cool. About is working perfectly. You all, my master plan. It's about 50-50, right? So I'm guessing the other folks who didn't raise their hand, right, would want the printed, correct? Or others say, I don't care, let someone else drive? Okay. Here's the thing, if you think about it. Let's say you're a map person, you want the map, and then someone gives you the words. Now, it doesn't mean you won't get there. I mean, you're smart, bright people, but it's just going to make you work almost against type. It's going to make you work a little bit harder because you prefer the visual representation of the data, and you get the words. Now, let's spin it around the other way. Let's say you want the words and someone gives you the map. Again, doesn't mean you're not going to get there, but like my wife and I, she needs the words, I need the map, because she'll do the thing where she'll spin it around, right? As we're driving, we turn south, suddenly, you know. So suddenly the airport is like down in South County. I'm like, what? You know, this isn't right. So, but it works out, because we each have our thing, and that's how we get there. So I use this as a setup to say, each of us have the way we want to approach problems. Each of us has a certain way we want to attack an issue or move forward. And we tend to want to deal with people the same way we want to be dealt with on the receiving end. But as I set up this, the five decision-making styles, I want you to keep in mind this idea that whether you're a map person or the word person, when you're dealing with folks to influence them, we have to make all sorts of adjustments. Otherwise, just like with kids, what works with child one will not work with child two, three, or in Karen's case, nine, right? Was that nine kids? Giddy up! Nine kids. Ask her about it. Yeah, to be clear, she's one of nine. She doesn't have nine kids, so that's why she's smiling. No, I was kidding. So, and she looks well-rested, exactly. So, but here's the thing. A couple of researchers, Miller and Williams, did this research across a whole host of CEOs, Fortune 500 companies, mid-sized, the whole deal, asked them a barrage of questions, observed them, asked people to work for them, the whole thing, and then they put together what they believe are the five different kinds of decision-making styles that are out there. Now, there's all sorts of personality tests. There's Myers-Briggs, and there's DISC, and there's Colby. There's all sorts of things like that. But what I thought was kind of fun about this is it looked specifically at how people make decisions. And so we're going to walk through them relatively quickly here as we move on to the next two sections, but use this kind of as a basis to say, okay, when we use our tools of persuasion, which person would this be best to use with, that sort of thing, all right? So let me give them to you real quickly, the five, and then we'll unpack them. Okay, the first one, they labeled as the charismatic. Okay, this is what they called that person. Not personality per se, just that's how they made decisions. So charismatic, number one. Number two, the thinker. Not the sculptor, Rodin, the whole thing, but the thinker. Number three, the skeptic. Everyone's favorite. Number four, follower. Bah. So, I'm sorry. Nothing bad there. Okay. And number five, controller. So we'll give them to you again. Charismatic, thinker, skeptic, follower, controller. And just for fun, here are the percentages that where they broke down, at least in this study. Charismatic was a quarter, basically 25%. The thinker was 11. The skeptic was 19. The follower was 36. Isn't that interesting? Almost 40% of the people were followers, yet they would not fancy. Yet they were leaders of companies. It's amazing. And then the last one is 9%. And that should add up to 104%. No, I was kidding. If it doesn't add up to 100, just take a few off of one of them. I know, I know who my audience is, right? So, but let's kind of go through. And as you think about this, I want you to think of two aspects. One, which of these best describes you, if you had to be completely honest? And then number two, which of these best describes some of the people you need to influence, whether it is a client or it's someone else in the C-suite or wherever these folks might be. Think of the people you have to deal with, and then we'll talk about how to best attack them in a loving way. So with the charismatic, don't let the name throw you off, because people instantly go, I want to be charismatic. Well, who doesn't? This is the idea of how they make a decision. So here's what they found. Charismatics are folks who get initially very excited about an idea. They'll get, oh, this is awesome. They're, yes, we can save the orphanage. This is great. I love it. It's done. Almost like, consider the contract signed. You know, that type of person. Yet, dot, 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 to actually make a decision, they will go back to their trusted advisors. They'll go back and meet with people, and they will then say, what do you think? You know, what's your opinion? What do you got? You know, what's your feedback on that? And then they'll actually base their final decision on gut feelings and what their input is from their trusted advisors. Okay? So I used to have a client like this, but tell me if you've ever the same thing. I had a client where we would present a wonderful, smart, talented guy. We'd give him some great layouts, you know, say for a magazine print or something in my days in advertising. He'd go, I love it. This is great. We could run this next month. Fantastic. And you almost think we could sign, you know, approval at the bottom. He says, let me just get right back to you. And we found out later that he would then go to his company, and he had about four or five people that he totally trusted. He'd go up their cube or go up to their office and say, what do you think of this? 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 And he'd get their opinion. And then he'd make his decision. He was a classic charismatic decision maker. So you can't get too excited about their initial excitement. Here's three strategies to work with these folks. One, if you can, use visual representation / pictures to present your idea. This is a very heavy map kind of visual person. So if you can take, instead of a PowerPoint filled with words, give them something to handle and touch and hold on to, some kind of visual representation will help out in your presentation of the data. Number two is to use straightforward arguments. And you say, well, no, duh. What I'm saying here is not a whole lot of nuance. And not that these people are afraid of sudden movements or anything, but just be as direct as you can. Don't add too much additional. These are like very much bottom-line people. Just give me the bottom line. What's the deal? Come on, tell me. Give me the facts. And then finally, be very results-focused. And you say again, well, no, duh, but think of it this way. There are some other people we're going to talk about in this list who are almost equally enamored of how you got your decision as they are the decision themselves. Right? There's some people out there who just get so, they're jazzed about whatever came here, but they're also excited. How did you decide to do that? That's so cool how you figured that out. Or I see why you went that direction. They get that excited as well. So here are just three words that in their survey found that if you use these words, it's not like it's a magic pixie dust, but if you'll use these words when you talk to them, they tend to have better resonance, or they at least kind of have a little bit more power. And some of them are obvious, some of them are kind of different. But for the charismatic, it was results, the word easy, for some reason, and focus. Results, easy, and focus seem to be words that they responded very well to. So I'm not saying you call your proposal the easy way to get IT done, you know, but with just the E and the Z, right? No, but just figure out ways, if you can, kind of pepper those words into your language. All right, let's move on to number two. Oh, by the way, a couple people who were classified as charismatics were Sir Richard Branson of the Virgin Atlantic and Virgin Everything, and then also Oprah. Oprah was a classic charismatic. Excited about stuff, but then goes back, trusted advisors, that whole thing, and then makes a decision. All right, next, the thinker. The thinker is the person who you cannot give them enough data. Data, data, data. Just pound it down with data. Now, you might be saying, well, wait a second, Steve. In your wonderful climate change example, you said data doesn't work. Well, data by itself won't, but this person places a high premium on research and on data and information. So just pound it down and give them as much as possible, or her. The other thing is, unlike the charismatic, this person wants to look at multiple options if at all possible. Like we go option A, option B, option C. That'd be cool. And then let them be able to be in the process of making that decision. Instead of here's the thus, therefore we have to do this. If ever possible, if you can let them be a part of that decision-making process, they like the how. This is the person who would take the lawnmower apart growing up and spread all over the garage or the front yard and then get in trouble when mom or dad came home. But they love how the lawnmower works just as much as the fact, oh, wow, it cuts grass too. That's neat. But they love how the whole thing works together. So they're very much in the how things, how you got to your conclusion. In fact, one of the folks they identify was Bill Gates. Bill Gates, if you would ever present to him, and I know he's doing his whole give away the money thing now, but my understanding is when you would present to him, he'd be just as excited about how you reached your conclusion as a conclusion itself, right? Now, let's also be fair. You can't always do this in every situation. Sometimes there's just we have to go with X. We just have to make that happen. That's fine. But if you even let them know how you got there, even if there's not multiple options, say, here's how we got to that decision, they'll respond to that and like it. Words that they liked were numbers, literally the word numbers, the word proof, and academic. Numbers, proof, and academic were words that they seemed to just, yay, They probably have kids named. This is our daughter, Academic, our son, Proof, and our dog, Number. Okay, so, all right, let's now move on to the skeptic. Now, everybody can almost instantly know what a skeptic is. This is a person that no matter what you say, up is down, right is left, you know, right is wrong, the whole, just, you can't make it happen. So, this is a very tough nut to crack. In fact, let me quick backtrack here. On the thinker, attacks on your proposal or attacks on your ideas are just that, attacks on the ideas. With the skeptic, attacks on your proposal, attacks on your ideas also have a little personal element to it. So it's kind of as and my family had to do the thing from Saturday Night Live, womp, womp, you know, the Debbie Downer. Whenever bad news comes up, we would just go, womp, womp, there's traffic. And now my daughter does it as well. So can I go play with Susie? Sorry, there's not enough time before dinner. Womp, womp, and then she just kind of mope away. But when you deal with a skeptic, it's kind of a bummer because when they come at you, it is that kind of womp, womp. There's a little bit of a personal element to it, but that's just how they are. Here's the way you approach this person. Stroke their ego. They are the smartest person in the room. You're fantastic, and oh my gosh, now you're a snappy dresser, but you're very bright, you know, that whole thing. you give that to them. And then here's what's interesting. If you can give them, if you can embrace or get endorsements from sources they trust, whether it's people, whether it's organizations, schools, wherever it might be, if you can find out the organizations and the entities that they trust and you can borrow or co-opt those, that'd be fantastic. Quick example. Anybody here ever seen in the grocery store, they actually, for dogs, they have Scooby snacks? Have you seen that they actually sell them alongside Milk-Bone, all that kind of stuff? Back in the day when I used to work at Ralston Purina, I actually came up with the idea of, wait a second, we should have Scooby snacks. Because my wife and I, just for fun with our dog, used the term Scooby snack. We went to our first veterinarian's office appointment, and she used the term Scooby snack. And I thought, I'm sitting on a gold mine. So I did all the research. I got all the information. I even met with Turner Broadcasting, who owned the rights to Scooby at the time. This is a few years back, right before the live-action movie came out with Sarah Michelle Gellar and Freddie Prinze Jr. and the whole deal. And it was all lined up. It was going to work out financially. It was fantastic. And then I went in to make my big pitch to our group director at the time. And I did it solo. And here's where I got in trouble. Kind of my wings melted because I got too close to the sun sort of thing. I did it by myself. And at the time, I was just a junior assistant to the manager, promotion, you know, sub-chapter. Just, I was nothing. Okay, I had no real title. It just was a neat idea. So when I went in and I made my presentation, it was ho-hum, kind of received not so well because the person I was dealing with, I believe, was a skeptic. Fine, wonderful, talented woman. She was very smart. But I had no endorsements from anyone that she trusted. Who's this guy? I mean, and I don't really blame her. I just was, okay, junior boy, thanks for coming in. You know, why don't you go get yourself a little Fresca, you know, or something like that. Yeah. And I scurried off, and it went nowhere. And then for about 4 or 5 years, nothing. And then eventually, it now came out. I forget if it's Kennel Ration or something like that actually makes it. And it could have been a Ralston product, but, you know, Purina, but that happens. I've been much smarter had I gone in and either found someone that she respected and either truly handed it off to him or her to go make that presentation, or at least gone in and co-presented the idea to that person with someone else they respected within the organization. Right? That's where I got a little bit of hubris got in the way, and it's like, oh, it can happen. But what's funny about that and why it didn't succeed, I made that presentation all about me and not about the idea. I made it about me and not about the company, you know, about me and not what the results could be. And so I really don't blame, yes, there's still, I've been through counseling for this, no. But I still kind of bummed about it, but it's really my own fault. I can't get mad at why she made that decision. I mean, the numbers were there, the facts were there, but I did not have an ability to help change her mind about how those facts were delivered because the messenger was no one she respected. I mean, it just happened. That's part of the deal. But anyway, so that happens. All right, so then here's the words for them. And I use this all the time, even for non-skeptics. I love this phrase. You probably already know this. Or I'm sure you're probably already aware of this. I mean, that's a classic because here's what's neat about that. If they didn't know about it, you just gave them off the hook. You let them off the hook. But if they did know about it, you're not insulting them. Like, of course I knew about that. Well, I just told you I knew. So you already know this. Or I'm sure you're well aware. I'm sure you've already seen this article, that kind of thing. So that's one. That's more of a set of words. And then also the word trust. Surprise, surprise. You have to have a trust person they like. And then also power. For some reason, they like the word power. So you probably already know this. Trust and power. Which brings us to the follower. Now, everyone kind of laughs at the follower. Oh, Mr. Follower. By the way, the skeptic, one of the ones they identified was Steve Case, the former CEO of AOL. This was this type of person, you know, this kind of decision maker. If you want to.
Who were your people for thinker?
Oh, it was Bill Gates. Sorry. Okay. Bill Gates was the main. I forgot the other person, but let's say it was Bob Smith. I don't know who that is, but is it? Yeah. CEO of something. Of Smith Corp. No. All right. So, so the follower. Here's what's interesting about the follower. Even though these are men and women who are CEOs of big companies and medium-sized companies, that's great. There's still this aspect of no one wants to stick their neck out and kind of make a bad decision, right? In fact, there's the old Chinese proverb of like the bird that sticks its neck out is the one that gets shot or something like that. In other words, you know, just kind of keep to yourself. Don't chirp too loudly and you'll live a long, happy life. But here's the story with followers. They want to think of themselves as innovators and kind of, you know, pushing the edge and that sort of thing, but they want to make sure someone else has done it first. Right? Okay, so if they could have this idea that maybe in another industry someone has done this, but not your industry. So, hey, there's a track record. Someone's already done this. It's already been proven. But you'd be the first in your area. You know, giddy up. Take it out. But they don't want to be the first one to be truly that innovative. So the things they respond to are arguments like, hey, give them testimonials from either clients or similar kind of industries. Let them know that it has been done before. And then here's what's interesting. If you can, in this person, even more so than the thinker, give them multiple options to choose from. So it's almost like with kids, you give them two or three outfits to choose. They can either, any one of those outfits will be fine for, you know, whoever going over to grandma's or something. But they get to choose, but you decided what the choosing was from, you know, among equals. They will love to feel innovative and, oh my gosh, I made that decision. I made this cutting edge thought, but really it was just something that's already been done before and you gave them several options to choose from. That's how that works. All right, then, the words that they respond to are similar to, previous, and then innovate, which is, seems kind of counterintuitive, but that's one of the weird things out there. All right. So then, and people who are followers, oddly enough, are our good friend Peter Coors. Now, if you think about Coors compared to AB, how AB is so innovative in terms of what they do and how they market and that sort of thing. Coors is great, but they seem that a little bit like a Johnny-come-lately sort of a thing. And if you think about even how they interact with the NFL, what AB realized pretty early on was that if you want to be the official beer of NFL, in every spot or print ad or whatever you do, you have to show all 32 logos. You got to show Seahawks and Browns and Packers. All of them have to show up somehow. Whereas then AB realized, and very smartly, you know what? The Steelers don't really care about the Browns. The Titans don't really care about the Packers, so why don't we become the official beer of the Rams or the official beer of the Seahawks, the official beer of the 49ers. That's all that matters. So then in that case, all I have to do is show the one logo of that team, and that's all your people care about in that local market. So it's just all sorts of examples like that. But that's where the follower comes in. And surprise, surprise, 36% of the people were classified as followers. Leaders of their company, but on some levels as they make decisions, not how they act, but how they make decisions, had very much kind of a follower. Has someone else done this? Then I'm happily move into it, and I'll make that happen. But I'm not going to be the, you know, stick my neck out. Which brings us to perhaps the ultimate womp-womp of the controller. This person is very difficult to persuade. This person is tough. They are very persnickety, if you will. And they're the person that the way to approach them is to give them data over time. Okay? And these folks, even more so than the skeptic, have to truly be the smartest person in the room. They're almost like mini dictators. Think of it that way. And the people they identified like this were, perhaps no surprise, Ross Perot and Martha Stewart. Right? And so that's how they identified them. So data over time. Here's what's neat about that. If you send them data over time, we don't always have that luxury, but when we do, if you could send them an article here, a white paper there, some research here, maybe a quick email there, you can then, almost like through osmosis, let it kind of percolate into their brain so they see it. When you actually have to make that proposal or make that recommendation or that directive, they'll almost be like, oh, yeah, I knew about that. And almost like, yeah, that was my idea. I'm just glad you kind of came and crystallized it for us. Thank you very much. But they want to feel like it was their idea. So the other thing about them is give highly structured arguments. I mean, every kind of thing. But here's the problem. Avoid aggressive advocacy. Be careful on how forceful you argue. So very structured arguments, but don't say, you got to do this, because the more you do that, we'll get them up and not be too happy. So here's my question. Oh, here's their three words, and then we'll do a little quiz. Their words are facts, as in F-A-C-T, not the machine, but facts, data. Number two, power. And the last one is grab. Grab, as in grab a bunch of potato chips. So for whatever reason, those words seem to be like, woohoo, they liked them. Some of these words like, I don't know, but just throw in the word grab and see what happens. No. Yes, sorry.
Is there any reason not to do all of these strategies
Okay, question is, should you not think about doing all of these to some degree and every time you go forward? Here's what I'd say. On the one hand, yes, but mainly no, and here's why. If you go towards the thinker wants to have a bunch of options and let them kind of think through the thing as it's their own deal. Whereas like the charismatic wants to just give me the bottom line, do it all for me. They don't want to know how you made the sausage, just does it taste good, right? So that'd be kind of an opposite thing there. The charismatic, again, doesn't need as much ego stroking as per se the controller or the skeptic, that sort of thing. But in general, I would say you are wise to at least keep in mind, if you don't know who that person is or how they operate, you just want to be open to how you might want to move forward. And you know what? I've had people ask me and they'd say, gosh, Steve, what if I'm going to present to someone or it's this kind of a weird panel or review or whatever? We don't have any idea who we're dealing with. Well, in that case, I'd say go with what you think, is just the best type of argument you can provide. And I'll actually touch on that a little bit when I talk about the three kinds of audiences. Okay, because this is just individuals. In a second, we're going to talk about the three kinds of audiences that are out there, because when you talk about an audience, you're talking about kind of a group dynamic that's going on. And you could have within one audience of 5, 10, 15 people, every manner of decision maker there. And you have to kind of just confront it that way. So that'd be my thought. So on the one hand, I guess if I had to pick one or the other, you gun to the head, which is very uncomfortable because it's hard to think that way. But if gun to the head, I would probably say to try to not do all things to all people. It's funny, a friend of mine started posting videos on YouTube. He does speaking and training, that sort of thing. And he started to get really angry when he found people would post both positive and negative things about him. Right there for the whole world to see. This is a stupid video. That was kind of dumb. And he realized he kind of got mad about that. This is kind of unfair. And he wanted to remove all those negative comments. And then he quickly realized, you know what? At least I'm taking a stand. You know what? I'd rather have them be loving me or hating me. But, you know, the lukewarm thing, no one wants that. People remember stuff they don't like and they remember stuff they do like. And so that's where I say you come in, just kind of, here's what we think, draw the line in the sand, and just kind of see what happens from there. So that kind of be my thought. But let's actually talk about, and thank you for that wonderful segue to the three types of audiences. Oh, before we do that, oh, yes.
So this may be a little backtracking. Back when you were talking about influence, you talked about people that you have power.
Yes.
In
fact, I should have set up better. What I mean here is these five decision makers are all people who you don't have power over. So I should have, thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, these are folks essentially who you cannot tell them what to do. You're approaching them. So thank you for that clarification. That's tell me who they are. In fact, here's my quiz for you all to think about, if you wouldn't mind. If you had to be real honest, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but just think about, of these five kind of decision-making styles, which one would you really put yourself on? Where would you put yourself in that continuum? Okay, so think about that for a second. And then now also think about the people you have to influence. And I'm sure, usually when I say this, people, I'm dealing with a skeptic. I got a half skeptic, half charismatic. Or, you know, whatever they got. They got some kind of little melange going on. But to think about, you're naturally going to want to have the person influence you the way you want to be influenced. But that's not going to happen. They need to be influenced the way they want to be influenced, sort of thing. So just recognize where you're coming from with the map and the instructions, that whole deal. Where do they want to come from and how do they want to be affected or dealt with. I'm sorry, if you sense what?
You sense that they're competitive.
Yes.
Does that play, obviously it's a
right. And competitive in the sense that if you come up with the idea, they're kind of bummed out, or what? How else might that play itself out? Okay, sure, yeah, right. Well, when I think about competitiveness, the couple folks who come to mind would be your skeptic and your controller. It would be people who would be competitive with you and think you can't tell me something I don't know, that sort of idea. But talk about competitive, I made the dumb decision to go with Scooby Snacks on my own because I was trying to be better and smarter and faster than my cohorts. I got the idea. So that kind of hurt me. Pardon? Yeah, so that was kind of dumb for me. So as I said, I made it more about me than about the idea or about the company. And I think we had a better situation. So there's certainly going to be competition. Pardon?
But being competitive myself.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Very good point. And so keep all that stuff in mind. Now we're going to turn the page and go to the different kinds of audiences. And we're just going to hit on this and then we'll unpack each one. The first one is a hostile audience. And that's pretty much everyone laughs, like, that's the only one I need help with, right? The other two are not that bad, but you'll see the other two. The other one is what I call the ho-hum audience. They know what's going on, but they, whatever. And the last one, it's easy, but I got to bring it up anyway, is kind of the happy audience. In other words, they're at least inclined to lean your way. They're already kind of on board. There's not a whole lot of influencing going on. So hostile, ho-hum, and happy. Now, the hostile, here's the thing. They already know what you want to do, and they're dead set against it. They do not want to be a part of it. This is almost like your jury pool, right? They're not on board. One of the ways to think this through is to present, instead of just your side of the argument, go ahead and present their side of the argument first. Go ahead and present. I understand you're probably thinking X, Y, and Z. You know, am I correct? Is this part of the things that are going on? Deal with what's happening there. And then once you've kind of talked about their side of the argument, then begin to talk about other options and certainly your own. Then that comes in. And if there's any way to find the slightest area of agreement, let's say on the 10 points you disagree on, there might be one that there's just the slightest bit of overlap, then go with that. You know, start with that kind of area. But approach these people. They already aren't. You almost have nothing to lose. You've already, in somewhat, almost already lost the game. So why not go for it and have some fun with it? You can be a little bit more bold with these folks, even though they're dead set against you. But if you'll find areas of agreement, present their side first, recognize where they're coming from, and then approach it with your ideas, you might have a better chance of working with them. The ho-hum audience, unlike them, they know what's going on, but they just don't care. They just don't see, well, how does this affect me? What does it matter? And I think very much like this, let's go back to college. We all had to take classes that we didn't like or weren't interested in, but we had to as a prerequisite. I'll never use this again, right? And the teachers and professors who did a better job of understanding how even the slightest little nugget of information affected them or dealt with them, the better. Now, my class, and maybe you all loved it, but for me, I was a French lit and European history major, right? So very practical stuff. But back in high school, I did math, but it didn't get me all jazzed up. We had Mr. Hansen was our trig teacher. Now, for a lot of people who are in my camp or going to advertising or journalism, wherever they want to do, even nursing or whatever, are not going to use trig ever again in their life. So you come and you sit down, oh, Mr. Hansen, you know, the whole thing. I don't care about trig. Well, he very wisely and very smartly, at least connected every single day, he connects something in everyday life with what we're actually about to study. So like he'd start off one day and say, how many of you here came to school today either in a bus or a car? You know, most of the hands go up. How many of you like the fact that when you came to a stoplight and other cars are zooming past on the green light, you like the fact that your car had brakes? Oh, Mr. Hansen. You know, we kind of give him some trouble, that kind of thing. And he'd say, today we're going to talk about a key aspect of how disc brakes work, blah, 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 is directly related to this aspect of trigonometry and how this all works together. And so at least, even though we'll never use trigonometry in our own lives to build or design brake systems, at least he took it to something we cared about and made it kind of interesting. He showed some relevance. In other words, most people go wrong when they present to an audience like that and they present to them in a vacuum. Good for you, but what about me? You know, why does that matter? I once worked for a company I will not name, but they had a goal of, this is 3 or 4 years ago, to become a $10 billion company by the year 2010. And at the time, they were about a $7 billion company. So good for them. Nice goal. And 10 by 10, 10 by 10. They had T-shirts and mouse pads and, you know, walls. Just 10 by 10, 10 by 10. And I happened to ask one of the kind of the lower level folks just for fun. I said, oh, by the way, I hear all this 10 by 10 stuff. It's kind of a cool little moniker. It's neat. What do you get if you guys get 10 by 10? What do you personally get? Nothing. Just a slap, you know, pat on the back. And I thought, that's very motivating. That's a fantastic idea. I mean, at least give them some kind of bonus or something. I don't care. A half a day off or a picnic or, you know, throw them, I don't know, Jelly of the Month Club, something, you know. So it was very interesting. So there's another example of presenting or giving something in a vacuum that has just no relevance or it doesn't touch the people. So here's what you need to do with the ho-hum audience. Present to them the downside of inaction. In other words, if we don't do something, here's what's going to happen. Not if we do this, this will happen. Think of it the other way around. If we don't act, big bad stuff's going to happen. We don't want that to occur. The other thing is to, as I said before, appeal to their self-interest, which should be for anybody, but especially with this group, their self-interest needs to be stroked. That's where Mr. Hansen came in, or where the 10 by 10. There's no self-interest being motivated there. All right, so then, and the last thing is go ahead and use stories, use business narratives to kind of make it more interesting. Just like the hostile audience, they're not on board. They're not dead set against you, but they need something to kind of get them off the dime, and why should they care? And business stories, business narratives are powerful. So whether it's something that happened to you, something that happened to, like it was neat to see Jeff doing some like quotes from famous basketball coaches or whatever, that kind of starts to get at the idea of telling a story or using that business narrative. Which brings us, and we'll spend just a second on the happy audience because, duh, that's easy. Why do you need to influence someone who's already on board? Well, here's where you need to influence someone. These are a group of people who are understanding your idea, they understand the proposal, they want to do it, and they almost just need a couple things. One, they need to be reminded of why they've already done it. Like, don't start to shake now. Don't lose me. Stay with it. Here's why you've already said yes or why you're on board. That's a cool thing. Then number two, go ahead and arm them if you can with arguments or defenses for when they run into some roadblocks down the road. So in other words, it's all happy and great in the meeting, and then thank you very much, everyone shuffles out, and then they bump into a roadblock or they run into some kind of impasse. If you can prepare them for dealing with that impasse or that roadblock or that kind of stick-in-the-mud person or whatever it might be, how can you make that happen? So arm them with those ideas. So hostile, of course, is the worst. They're hard to deal with. But you need to find a way to connect with them. Present their idea first. The ho-hum, present the downside of inaction. Give them stories, be a little more bold. And then lastly, remind the folks who like you already why they're doing it, and then give them some tools to move forward. Okay, questions, comments, concerns, vicious personal attacks about either audience or individuals? Before we do the P's of, now we're getting to the P's of persuasion. Woohoo! All right. I think we're doing fabulous on time as well. All right, so here we have some ideas. And each one of these, by the way, is not just a, you ought to try that out, it's kind of fun. Each one of these is based in either social or psychological research from either some very respected journals, and I'll let you know what those are, or some of the big-time schools out there, that sort of thing. But each one starts with a P, and we give you the first one, and it is this idea of pay it back. You heard of pay it forward, this pay it back. Another term for this, but I made it a P, is reciprocity. Perhaps the most one of the most powerful social forces out there. And what that means is simply this. If someone does something nice for you, there is an unstated but agreed upon, in almost every culture out there, agreed upon, they did something nice for you, you want to turn around on some level and do something nice back for them. That's what the term, I'm obliged, much obliged. Well, why does that mean? I'm now obliged to do something nice for you because you did something nice for me. Let me give a couple simple examples and then kind of a heavy hitter example. Let's say it's a cold Midwestern afternoon, and you're running off to a store, it's freezing, you get out of your car, and you all you can think about is getting inside as quick as possible. And so you go up to this business, wherever you're going, and it's a place that has the two sets of double doors, right? So there's a little foyer, but they're about 10 feet apart. So you have to be walking at about the same speed as someone else, but you don't know them. There's that kind of who's going to go first kind of thing, a little dance. And you decide to take that wonderful chivalrous move, and you step forward, and you open the door for them, right? Kind of a little smile. They walk in. 99 times out of 100, what do they do to that second door? They open up for you. And then not to be too Machiavellian, who's the first one in the room or in the building? And you are, exactly right. You're the first one in the building because you took the step out, you took a little bit of a risk to stop, open up the door. They owe you nothing. There's no contract that was signed. I hereby open this door for you, and you thus, therefore, henceforth, must open a door for me, right? But people often do it because you'd feel like a chump. And when you've seen people do that before, they kind of like, they sneak in and they just want to get out of there, like, thanks for that, chump. Same thing, let's go to another example. If you ever get hungry and have much money, just go to Sam's on a Saturday morning, right? You will get food, woo! It's like a Thanksgiving feast. I mean, you got sausages and pizza, and it's unbelievable. But here's what's funny. You walk up and you want the thing, but you know ahead of time you have no intention of ever buying it. So you walk up and you have to feign interest. Oh, that interest. What's this called again? Pizza? What? Whoa! So neat, how you put that together, that's really delicious. And then it's terrible. You have the freedom at that point. You just took a little bite of pizza, and you can just walk away. But I always feel like, let me think about it. I might, this is delicious. I might come back. You know, you just want to get out of there. But there's that weird feeling because you feel obliged. They did something nice for you. They didn't say you have to buy it, but it's just that kind of odd thing. Well, some social scientists want to put this to the test in general. How does this happen? So it's a very famous study, the Reagan study, R-E-G-A-N, conducted this actually in the 70s, but it holds up to today. And what they did is they tested two people, one's in on the deal and one isn't. And they were observing, they were doing some work, basically some busy work and filling out some paperwork, and it took them a little while. And it was legitimate work, but one person was just kind of, again, in on the deal, and one person was just filling out the paperwork at this university. And the person who was in on the deal would all of a sudden, in the middle of the paperwork being filled out, just would stand up, not say a word, would leave, and come back with two ice-cold Coca-Colas, you know, with the top's already off, and doesn't say a word, said, thought you might like this, you know, just, and then sits down. They both drink their sodas. Then what they did is afterwards, as they're both standing up to leave, the person who brought the soda would say, "You know what? My daughter's selling some raffle tickets for this upcoming event. Would you like to buy some?" And then they tested how many people bought with the Coke, and then in the situations where they didn't give them a Coke, right? They found that when all they did was give them the Coke, sales of the raffle tickets went up 500%. And then here, if you think about it, here's what was so astonishing. The person who was on the receiving end of the Coca-Cola didn't say, "Woo, I'm thirsty." The person who did the giving just decided what the offer was. They decided when it was given. They also then decided when to ask for the favor in return, right? So they're totally in control the whole time. But because of reciprocity, the person goes, "Wow, you gave me a Coke. Yeah, I'll buy some raffle tickets." Here's the little kicker about it, though. They also asked the people. In some cases, when they gave the Coke, the person was kind of they're a little snotty about it. They're just kind of not the nicest person in the world. And other times, they're the nicest person ever. But they gave the Coke in either situation. They found that people bought just as many raffle tickets from the person they didn't like as the person they did like. In other words, the social power, the social norm of wanting to give back and reciprocate in some way was stronger than personality. So just keep that in mind as you do nice things for people. It's nice to be nice to them, but if you're not, hopefully it'll kick in and pick up for your loss there. And actually, that was in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology is where that was posted. Yeah. So, and I also want to be clear here, not in kind of this karma-esque way, but this is just kind of a nice, good planet thing to do. Just if you're nice to other people, you know what? There's that social power they want to give back to you. Now, you can't do it purely for the "please give back to me" kind of thing. If you're doing it for that, then it starts to kind of take away the whole deal. You know, almost like when you're a kid, I gave a good friend of mine a really nice present, hoping they'll give me a nice present. Well, you should give them a nice present just because it's the right thing to do, not because you want to get something back. But that's the pay it back aspect. All right, number two, peer pressure. It's not just for high school anymore. All right, when you hear about peer pressure, another term for this, the official term is social proof. But basically what this means is people want to do what most other people are doing. Or in other words, they don't want to be a part of the smaller group of folks who aren't doing a particular thing. And here's what they want to test. You see now in hotels a lot, there's a little placard on top of the towels when you first walk in there. A new little placard's kind of sitting there. It's a note or it's something pinned on or a little piece of plastic. And it says something like, "Hey, we're interested in being more environmentally conscious," and this sort of thing. So if you want to consider hanging up your towel instead of throwing them on the floor, that would help us out and be good for and be green and that sort of thing. So please consider doing that. And they found that there's a certain percentage of population who will agree with that and go ahead, that's enough of a motivator. But some social scientists want to say, "Hey, what if we modified what that card said, just with one extra sentence? Could we affect how many people hang up a towel or don't use a towel again, that sort of thing?" So here's what they did. All they added was this one sentence. Well, what was already there was, "We at the hotel think it's good to be environmentally friendly and this sort of thing, so would you please consider consider reusing your towels," period. Here's what they added. "We have found that the majority of our hotel guests reused at least one towel one time during their stay." Doot. Right? They got an increase in 26%, 26% increase right off the bat, nothing else, by just adding that line. Now, here's what happened there. Suddenly, let's say you're in room 413 at the Sheraton in Cincinnati, which is a lovely place, by the way. You don't really care who's in room 414 or 412. What does that matter? But if you know most of the people in the hotel are being kind of good citizens and hanging up the towel, you don't want to be the chump to be the towel on the floor person, right? Because for some reason about you guys, I don't even have hair to wash, but I use like six towels when I'm like, "Hey, a towel, hey." You know, I think sometimes I crumple them up and just throw them on the ground. It's just kind of fun. Like, where does that come from, right? But now they're trying to change us to say, "Hey, you don't have to be a towel freak. You know, just go ahead and use just as many as you need, but consider hanging them up." And by saying, "Hey, you know what? Other people are doing it." In fact, not just other people, most other people are doing it. So I was talking to a woman who was basically a compliance officer at among other things, at this big hospital organization. They're having a terrible time with people coming in late. Now, if you think about it, the coming in late was only like 7 or 8% of the population. But if you're working a 12-hour nurse shift, right, and you can't leave till the next person comes in, you can't. I knew you're code blue, but I got a birthday party to go to. You got to wait for that person to arrive. So they incorrectly said, "We're having a huge problem with people coming in late." No, they switched it around. "We found the vast majority of people are coming in on time and doing the right thing." And they kind of positioned it that way. So now the small percentage, the 7 or 8%, started to feel like chumps of the world. And they're able, just by the way they positioned it, to reduce their late problem. All right. So think about it for you all. What can you do as you think about people you need to influence? Instead of saying, "We got this huge problem with a small minority causing an issue." No, actually, it's a small group. That's fine. Focus on the vast majority of the people who are doing the thing correctly and focus on it from that perspective, right? And same thing with back on the pay it back. What can you do without the expectation of getting anything in return, oh, that's very nice. What can you do to give them something nice with the hope that it will come back? And you'd be amazed what that can do for you. All right, next one is promise slash predictability. Promise slash predictability. And what this means is people, when they make a commitment of some sort, will, as long as it's a socially desirable behavior, will tend to want to act predictably or consistently with that promise and actually do it. So here, a couple examples. Let's say you ask someone to help you out on something. Let's use like a not-for-profit. Hey, maybe it's even working here on the board or something. Hey, not right now, but hey, next February, would you consider serving on the board? Oh, great. I'd love to. That'd be great. And they actually say they want to. We got to come back to them. Serving on the board is a wonderful, socially desirable behavior, right? And so they've already said, yes, I'd like to do it. When you come in to kind of call that favor, they're going to have a tendency to want to agree with that. They're going to want to agree and actually act consistently with the behavior they've already expressed. So a couple ways that some scientists want to test this. They looked at actually a restaurant of all places, and they had a pretty bad problem. A nice restaurant out in L.A. had a problem with people making reservations and then not showing up, right? Because it's like renting a car, right? If you don't show up for a rental car, you know, big deal. They don't take your credit card or anything. It's like, we hope you'll come and get your car. So they had about 30% of the people would get a reservation, and then they would not actually show up. So here's what they changed. They made an adjustment. They went from, thank you, we have you down for 8 o'clock this Friday night, party of four. Thank you very much, Mr. Hughes. And please call us if you need to cancel. Click. All they changed was this. We have you down for 8 o'clock this Friday. Looking forward to it, Mr. Hughes. Would you please call us if you need to cancel? Pause. Yes, I will. By just making them say, yes, I will, or yes, I'll call you, their no-shows went from 30% down to 10. In other words, a socially desirable behavior is to stick up. You know, if you say you're going to do something, you actually do it, and you got them to say yes. The other example, this is a classic. Also out, I believe, in Beverly Hills. This is a tough one. Let's say you had a really fancy house, Beverly Hills, beautiful manicured lawn. A group of researchers came up and said, hey, do you mind if we put a fairly large, 8x10 billboard in your yard talking about the importance of driving carefully, driving safely? We've had some issues around here lately. Only 17% of the people surveyed in this neighborhood said, yes, you can put a kind of a giant billboard in my yard. I mean, because they're worried about, this looks ugly, and you're going to muck it up, you're going to dig a hole, it's just not very cool. They then said, what if we kind of grease the skids a little bit first? What if we go to them and get them to agree on something smaller, but they say yes to it first? Would that then lead to a better agreement on the bigger sign? So they went to a very similar neighborhood, not the exact same one, but a very similar neighborhood, same city. And instead of saying, can you put this giant 8x10 billboard in your yard with posts and all that sort of thing, would you mind putting just this 18-inch deal in your window for a period of time that says, please drive carefully? And they got a high percentage of people to go ahead and say that yes. Well over the 65% of the people said yes, they'd do it. Then when they went back to about 3 weeks later, hey, would you also mind if we put in a giant 8x10 billboard in your yard? They got 76% of those people said yes. Now, it's just because they made this initial yes of, you know what, I made this kind of promise, I'll kind of help you out and do a nice thing. They kind of got their foot in the door, so to speak, and now they're asking for something larger. Now, we all know this can work great in general. You ask someone for a small commitment, no big deal, get them the thumbs up, get them to smile, everything's happy, then you ask for the bigger commitment. And so people are going to want to act consistently with that sort of thing. So that's your promise predictability. Number four, and this is kind of a fun one, is just progress, the word progress. Here is the concept that if people feel like they're making progress towards a goal versus they're just starting out from nothing or they got a much longer way to go, it's harder to make people actually move forward and make it happen. So in the Journal of Consumer Research, some psychologists wanted to find out, okay, if we went to a car wash just for fun, we go to this car wash and we give out, for everyone who comes there, a loyalty card, okay, X number of punches and you get a free wash, right? All sorts of those things. Well, they had two different cards they gave out to people. One had just 8 spots to fill in, so 8 punch cards. The other one had 10, but the first two were already punched. Okay, right? So it's still 8 in either case. You have to get 8 for this one, 8 for this one. But these folks already had 20%. Oh, we're 20% of the way there. But here's what they found, oddly enough. They found that they had 34% more people with the 10 card than the two already punched said yes, and they also did it in 2.9 fewer days. In other words, they got their washes faster, and they actually went ahead and got all 8 washes. And you say, well, how ridiculous is that? Well, now let's think about a big project you're working on. It's so easy to go, oh my gosh, we have so far to go, versus, and don't do this all the time, but once in a while, focus on, oh my gosh, we're already this far along the way. Let them feel like there's some completion already under the bridge. Water's going under the bridge. Bridges don't go under the water, usually. But you could try. It's very weird. So it's kind of goofy, but it makes sense. Now, even think about with kids. Let's say you have a kid who has to write a 5-page paper, and they've only written the first page. One option, oh, you've only written one page? Oh, my gosh, you have 4 to go. We're never going to get done, you know? And American Idol's coming up. No. But versus, oh, my gosh, you've already written one page. That's cool. You're so far. That's great progress. 20% of the way there. Giddy up. Make it happen. If you focus on what they've already done and kind of act like, hey, the ball's already rolling. We got kind of the snowball's kind of rolling down the mountain. It's just, gosh, 4 more pages, get it done. So think about the projects you work on. Can you, in the appropriate time, in the appropriate way, think about how you could have them focus on what's already been done and not focus so much on how far they have to go? It's kind of a goofy thing, but it works out. By the way, I meant to say one other thing on promise predictability. Hosts of research have been done, or studies have been done, on people and getting them to commit to vote. So here's what they do. They'd say, hey, will you vote next Tuesday in the election? And they'd wait for them to say, yes, I'm going to vote. And then they cranked it up a notch and said, great, I'll let some of the other folks around here know you're going to vote. Thanks, we can really count on you. So what they did is they then also made the commitment public. So if you can add that, friend, ask that aspect. If you can make that commitment verbal, written, you know, blood, somehow, whatever it is, make it have a public aspect to it, woo, that becomes something. Reminds me of a good friend of mine I used to work with. He said, there's 2 kind of goals in life. There's the get-up goals and the get-down goals. He said, the get-up goals you never tell anyone about. That's the, I want to make $1 million by the time I'm 30. I want to become a regional vice president by here. I want to get this kind of thing. I want to win this award. Because if it doesn't happen, you're like, failure. But on the get-down goals, I want to lose weight. I want to quit smoking. I want to do this. Then you want as many people to know about that because you've made your commitment public, and they can come to you and say, oh, stay away from the, you know, no more ding-dongs for you. Or Bob's having a birthday, but you should probably skip the cake, you know, that sort of thing. You want people, in that sense, to be public and know about what's going on to help you achieve that goal because you've made that commitment and it's socially desirable. All right, number 5 is, and I had to fudge a little bit on this one, so run with it, all right? It's reposition the issue. So I put the re in parentheses just for fun. So reposition the issue. I just found no other way to make this happen. If you have a good P word on this one, please let me know afterwards. It changed my life forever. What this means is it's the idea of anchoring and reframing, such that even just by the language you use, you can change how people think about an issue or a topic. And let's give a few examples. One from both sides of the political aisle, just again to be fair. Back in the 90s, there was it was interesting. In fact, both these examples come from the 90s. Folks were having a hard time. Republicans were having a hard time trying to convince people that the estate tax was a bad thing. You know, the estate tax. But the estate tax wasn't getting much traction because the estate tax sounds like, oh, you must be Thurston Howell III. Or you must be Richie Rich. Or you must, you know, I don't have an estate. I just have a small business. Or I have a small farm. No big deal. They changed the word from estate tax to death tax. And suddenly I said, wait a second. I think I'm going to die someday. What? You're going to charge me 55% if I don't have this protect? What? Are you kidding me? I've already paid taxes. I won't have to pay again. That doesn't seem right. And so he suddenly got traction on the issue. And it was amazing what that could do. Similarly, on the other side of the aisle, President Clinton, for the first time ever, and I think it's been used ever since then, instead of talking about spending, is a very tough word, spending, who wants to do spending? However, people like investment. Can we invest in here? Let's invest in education. Let's invest in energy. Let's invest in this kind of thing. Let's invest over here instead of let's spend. People don't like that. But by just changing the word, it can completely change people's opinion. Now let's see if you guys can figure these out. People used to always say the word gambling. What do they call it now? Gaming, it's Monopoly. Hey, it's Tiddlywinks. It's nothing. It's gaming. All right, how about another one? No one buys used cars anymore. What do you buy? Pre-owned. Oh, this has been pre-owned. I'm not the first owner. That's pretty cool. It's a pre-owned car. Awesome. Used cars suck. Hey, is it a used car, Bob? No, it's pre-owned. Back off. All right? Yeah, and now, exactly right. Crank it up a notch. It's certified. What does that mean? I don't know. Here's another question. For those of you who know about this area, when someone is buying an engagement ring, how much money are they supposed to spend? What's the recommended amount? 3 months' salary. Yeah, it's actually 2 months, but some people say 3 months. Okay, 2 months' salary. Just quick question. Where's that from? Exactly. It is De Beers. Exactly. In fact, he's right. It is. Yeah, yeah. It was a woman at De Beers. Probably after she caught her husband doing... No. So, here's the thing. You're right. And it is De Beers who first came up with it. And here's what's interesting, why that was successful. In general, people accept it because here's the thing. In the absence of some other contravening kind of evidence or data to say why that's not a good idea, okay. I mean, just out of the blue, just pick 2 months' salary. I mean, I think what they did very smartly is they said, what's enough to kind of really stick it to the guy? But not so much that he won't actually spend the money, right, and go cubic zirconium, right? So, but that's what I mean. In other words, you can pick things, you can basically set your own anchor in the absence of some other kind of contravening data or evidence. I'm not saying you fool the people. I'm just saying you're the one who decides what the thing is. You call it the death tax. You call it investment. You call it gaming. Or you call it 2 months' salary. That's your choice. But what can you say to position the issue the way you want it to be seen? And it's amazing what that can do for you. Now, just because I'm a giver and I like to give, I got one more for you. Oh, yeah. All right, number six. You're like, oh, he just doesn't stop. So hopefully this is a bonus, right? Ding, ding, ding. Okay, number six. This is kind of a cool one. This is a problem/plan. Okay, problem/plan. Okay? But there's always that thing of giving more than you expected. Because if I told you it was going to be 5, 3, 6, you'd be like, that's all I was expecting. I could have done. I'm going to give you one idea and give you 15, but anyway. So problem/plan. Here's what I mean by this. JetBlue, if you recall, February 2007, there's a horrible nor'easter, just really, really bad storm. And basically everyone, United, American, Delta, everybody in the Northeast said, we're grounding our planes. Sorry you can't get home to wherever you're going to grandma's, but you ain't getting there. And JetBlue said, we can do it. And then that's where we had all those horrible stories in the news about people sitting on the tarmac for 13 hours, you know, just horrific, running out of food, just toilets overflowing. It just was awful. PR nightmare. And so then JetBlue is faced with a decision to either say, you know what? They either take it on the chin, we made a stupid mistake ourselves, or they could blame it on an act of God, which it was. I mean, it was. They can't control the weather unless they've got something we don't know about. You cannot control the weather. So here's what they did very bravely and very wisely. They said, you know what? We made a bad internal decision. Our fault, our mistake. However, here are the three things we're going to do to make sure that never happens again. Now, they did take an initial PR hit on that. However, what they found was investors said, hey, you know what? I appreciate you owning up to your mistake, and I appreciate you saying, here's what you're going to do to go forward. And actually, after that, their stock price started to go back up because people want to invest in companies that are in control of their own destiny, not, out of control, we can't control it. Our natural human tendency is to instantly blame stuff out here, you know, not my fault. All the stuff happened out here. And even if the stuff did happen out here, that does happen, when you can step forward and take responsibility with a plan of how it's not going to happen again, people like that. Here's the three things they liked about it. One, it shows you're capable. Number two, it shows you're honest because people kind of know anyway that it was your fault, no matter what's going on the outside. And number three, they like the fact that you're in control. So you're capable, you're honest, and you're in control. They like that. So then let's look at that across on a larger scale. Of all places, the Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin, which I don't know about you guys, I read that every week. But they published an interesting study. They looked at 14 Fortune 500 companies over a 21-year period. 14 Fortune 500 companies, 21-year period, 20-year period. And they examined in their annual reports, in the years when they blamed stuff on the outside, no, we couldn't help it, bad stuff, when they blamed things out there, they found that the next year, their stock price was lower. For every time the companies would own up to things went wrong, but we made a mistake and took it on the chin, explained it, they're honest, they're capable, and they're in control, the following year their stock price was higher. So how does this help you as an influencer? When you can recognize a problem, the first thing you want to do is you want to push it on the table, right? Just pretend it's not there. If you can recognize and confront a problem and deal with it and admit where your true responsibility was, along with, proactively, by the way, not being found out, but proactively, along with a plan of how to overcome it, you can increase the way people see you as being more honest, more capable, more in control, which may not help you in that initial moment, but will definitely help you down the road when you run into another problem, which eventually one's going to come. It's just going to be there. So so it's this idea of where's internal, where's external happen, but as much as you can take it on the chin, here's another cool stat. They found that trial attorneys who will, on their own, say in their either opening argument or in their early discussion in their arguing part of the case, if they'll admit to a shortcoming in their own argument, Yes, my client can't really vouch for where he was that night. However, blah, 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 because it's going to come up anyway. But if they could proactively say, here's a little bit of the shortcoming in our argument, but here's how we're going to overcome that. Here's why that is going to hurt us. They found those people tended to win their cases 34% of the time. Then things are going to come out anyway. So that's the whole deal. The idea is going to come up. He didn't have an alibi. It was going to come up. So why not have you be the person to bring it up proactively, because it shows, hey, we're not just going to blow a bunch of smoke. So if we're going to admit on this issue that we messed up or that he doesn't have an alibi, then on all the other stuff that we say that's really good, ding, they're going to like you and trust you more. So same with you all. If you see a problem with a client, instead of waiting for it to bubble its head up, if you can step forward, admit it yourself with a plan of how to overcome it, you'll find that that'll help a long-term relationship. Short-term, maybe a little rough, but long-term will definitely help you. I do want to revisit, if we could, going back to the jury trial. My friend I told you about down there was hoping, please pick me, please pick me. Well, she went home that night, wasn't able to talk to her husband that day, and he walks in there talking, getting dinner ready, and she's just bummed out. Her face is downcast. She is just really not happy. And he said, oh, I guess you got chosen, didn't you? And she said, no, I didn't make the cut. And she was bummed out because she didn't get a chance to serve on jury duty, only because of the way that the prosecutor positioned it and made it kind of a thing to be cherished, and which it really is that kind of an honor. He had to restore. Basically what he did there, if you think about it, he repositioned the issue. That's exactly what he did. The issue was, you have to do it. It's a burden. It sucks. It's a bummer. But no, it's an honor, and it's a privilege, and only certain people should be allowed to do it. Now, yes, he really kind of went a little far, if you ask me, but it worked. It worked really well. And let me put it back to you all. As you think about the people you interact with, whether you interact with them at your level or below, with the four R's, or the people at your level you have to report to, the five different styles out there, or the three kinds of audiences you might face, or the six, seven, or even eight fabulous ways you can influence them with the P's out there. Thanks, Tori. What's your name, by the way?
Yeah.
Craig. Thank you very much, Craig. If you just understand who the person you're dealing with, you understand the resistances and can kind of neutralize them first, then approach them with one of the P's of persuasion, you'd be amazed at how much your influence ability goes up. And I really believe this to my core, that great persuaders, great influencers are made, not born. Anybody can do it. Thank you very much, and appreciate your time.
This has been a Steve Hughes audio program. For more information and resources to help you look and sound smart when you talk, visit hityourstride.com.